Broadway Baby, the podcast taking one casual theater goer to full out fangirl. I'm your host, Kimberly Schmidt, here with my husband, Jay Schmidt.
Hi, guys.
And our baby, Alex Fasella.
Hello.
And today we listened and we're talking about Violet, the musical, the Jeanine Tesori classic.
Being on a Bus, the musical.
Yes. Bus Stop, the musical, not to be confused with actual Bus Stop, the musical. Oh, no, that's Diner.
Diner's Bus Stop?
No, I get them confused.
Oh.
I don't think they're the same thing at all.
Oh, I guess they did do Diner the Musical, didn't they?
They tried.
Wait, based on the Barry Levinson movie Diner?
Yeah, huh. You know, I mean, they're trying to turn all sorts of movies into musicals nowadays, so why not?
Here's my ad campaign for why Practical Magic should be a musical.
Yeah.
Not really. Anyway, has Baby met World?
Only a little bit. It's spring and nice out, so I took a walk and did my annual listen through of Spring Awakening. I usually do when it's warm out or if I need to make myself sad to purge some things.
Did you be both?
No, I was okay. I was okay this week. But I still like it. I still kind of think the lyrics are word salad, but damned if it isn't a good show.
And word salad, that's good.
Yeah.
That is 100%.
Yeah.
Yep.
The poetry? That's what you call poetry?
No, I quite like poetry. This works
out. I know, I'm kidding. You like it.
Yet I still love the show. It's kind of the damnedest thing. I'm like, well...
Alex, you had a haircut.
I did. It was time.
Podcast can't see this, but I just realized that Alex got a very significant haircut.
I had long hair, and I was going for like the Lin-Manuel long look, and I was like, I can't, it's not working out. Let's get rid of it. It's time.
Quarantine hair, it's gone.
Yes, that was my excuse. I was like, let's experiment. But and then I got because we're doing a Jeanine Tesori show, I jumped around Fun Home. I didn't listen to it all the way through because as much as I love Fun Home and adore every second of it, that's a big emotional commitment to be like, I'm going to do Fun Home to myself today, you know?
Yeah.
So I jumped around kind of like the catchy songs, but then oddly enough, I got fixated on just playing the finale over and over again. And it's not that I don't, not that I never didn't like the finale. I think it's amazing, but I rarely listen to finales for fun just because with the shows that I like, they tend to be very heavy, the ending. Like I love Hamilton. I'm not just putting on Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Tells Your Story because it's sunny out and I want to take a run. Like that's not going to happen.
That's not the single of the
No, song. Exactly. Exactly. But I just listened to Flying Away over and over and over again, just because I was so, I always appreciated it, but I'm just growing more and more to love the more I think about it, the way that that show deals with kind of a fractured timeline where there's three of her and that they only really sing together, all three, when she's processed the emotion and it's so powerful. And the line I got fixated on that I honestly forgot was there because I hadn't listened to the finale too many times was older Allison is saying, Daddy, I want to play airplane. I want to fly. And then middle Allison is going, how does it feel to know that you and I, and then the implied lyric is, are both gay. And it was just so, that hit me over and over again that I was just like, I kept backing up the song, like just replaying it because I just wanted that moment over and over again. It's so good.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We agree. I love getting fixated on parts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have we met any world? I got you your birthday present.
Oh, yes. For my birthday, Jay got me records. Do you want to say which ones?
Well, we were always talking about, we have a record collection for our hi-fi system, but it's a lot of old musicals. And Kimberly was like, oh, well, like we should get some musicals like so we can expand our collection so we can pass down like the musicals that we like. As records, and so I got her some musical records, and I got her the Prom, the 2-disc set of Prom, which they're teal records. They're really fun.
Yeah.
And I got her Dear Evan Hansen, just because I'm problematic show, but the music is very, very good.
Yep.
And then the most expensive one, and I didn't realize like truly.
It's what I'm most excited about.
And I got her the three, and I realized now that it's 3 discs. I didn't realize that was 3 records and why it was like easily like the, hey, this was expensive. it's the full recording on vinyl of Hadestown. It's
the whole show.
It's the whole show. Oh,
cool.
Yeah.
I'm pumped.
So all the dialogue is there and all the... Is it a live recording or is it an in-studio just complete show?
I don't know, actually.
We haven't listened yet because we haven't had 3 hours.
Because I'm curious, did they just like do the whole show in a booth or did they record a live one or what? But that's really cool. Because the first album, the Off-Broadway one, was live. So it would be interesting to kind of do the Broadway one live, or if they just did it, I'd be into it in the booth. It's just like radio play style too, but that's fun.
We will let you know.
Yes. That'll be your meeting of world.
Yes. But mostly we've been listening to The Prom. I think that's the only one we opened.
Okay. They're teal. I like when the records are different colors and teal is the color of The Prom. No one can see
so
teal
good.
Or purple, but it's mainly teal.
It's a teal, like kind of marbled teal purple.
Yeah.
Like purple teal. Actually, listened to I was flipping around like YouTube movie reviews, and a reviewer that I kind of like reviewed The Prom Netflix movie and said that his beef, he didn't like it because he said the story of the Broadway actors distracted him from the story of Emma. And I don't think so at all. I think they work really well together.
Yeah. Also, the juxtaposition is the point.
Yeah. Like without
both stories is the point.
Without Barry and Beth Level, it's Fun Home. Not that Fun Home isn't great, but like it's not the prom anymore.
It just solved itself. They were solving it in the first scene with Emma.
Yeah, that's the whole point.
And then the Broadway actors came in and screwed it all up.
Yeah, like that's the beauty of the show.
The show would have been over.
Exactly. And he's just like, I would rather just have this little love story. I'm like, I'm sure that would have been good, but it wouldn't be The Prom anymore.
Yeah,
like,
but that's not what this is.
That's a different show, right? A different show.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm so tired of reading reviews and it's just like, well, it should have been this. I'm like, this is not a review. Like, review what you're actually watching.
No notes.
Either you're a critic or you're a writer.
A theater writer.
Yeah. And you're just mad that you didn't get a chance to write the show. All right. Shall we
word of the week?
Word of the week.
Drama desks.
You know what they look like.
Speaking of The Prom. Jay, do you know what they look like?
I don't actually.
A drama desk award has gone through many iterations, but it usually looks a bit like a feather. A feather pen.
Huh.
I see.
Like it might be on your desk.
Like a quill.
Like a quill on your desk.
Like
for
a
while
desk
you are
for
writing
plays.
Exactly. I'm sure I've seen one because I've seen The Prom, but I couldn't remember what they looked like.
Yeah, true. The drama desks are, interesting. Originally known as the Vernon Rice Awards. They're an annual award first bestowed in 1955 that recognizes excellence in New York theater productions. The main difference between the drama desk and the Tonys is that the drama desks include off-Broadway performances and productions.
Yes.
And so the drama desks happen before the Tony Awards. They are often sort of a predictor.
The Golden Globes of Tony.
They're the Golden Globes, kind of the Tony Awards, except that there are more eligible shows.
And the drama desks are more of a actual snapshot of what's going on in the entire theater community in New York.
It's like a more democratic Tony.
The Tonys are, don't get me wrong, I would love to win a Tony. Tony voters, I love you. You're great. But it's more that the Tonys are, hey, these are all the shows that had a lot of money and are trying to make more money, so we made this award show.
They're much more gatekept.
That's an oversimplification, but the drama desks are usually, the drama desks, even from the award shows, are really fun, but also like really, really niche New York theater performers. And also like the jokes are really, really like insidery baseball.
I'd be really interested to see like at any given year, what won best show at the Tonys versus what won at the drama desk, because I wonder, because we've kind of talked about that phenomenon, and the Oscars do this too, of they pick a choice that's kind of uninspired and then everyone forgets about it and it closes, and yet it was best musical. So I wonder, like, what if the drama desks, because there's just more shows, I wonder if they're better at picking like, oh, this show deserves to win and it's not just going to be fly by night kind of a thing.
What I find interesting about the drama desks is when a show is off Broadway and then it transfers to Broadway, the next year they're not eligible again.
Yeah.
Because if it's the same production, which then opens up the category. So for instance, Hamilton won the Drama Desk a year later at the Tonys, or 2 years later, I think, because of how they opened. They were not eligible for the Drama Desk, but they were going to sweep all of the Tonys. So then the Drama Desk gets interesting. That becomes then the coveted prize.
Okay. Because
you are not up against Hamilton. And so then that year becomes very interesting.
It was Evan Hansen's year, I think, at the Drama Desks, right?
And I think the same thing happened. Evan Hansen won the Drama Desk, and then the next year it opened itself up.
Okay, so they're kind of a predictor a
little bit.
Oftentimes
they do not match. For instance, Wicked won the Drama Desk, and Avenue Q won the Tony.
Which feels like it should be flipped, right?
I know, and I love it.
Yeah.
I love that Avenue Q beat Wicked.
Me too.
Wicked didn't need the help.
No.
It was fine. Didn't get good reviews, but everyone loves it
Wicked,
now.
Yeah. Wicked's still open, and Avenue Q ain't, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, something I found interesting when looking up some of the cast of Violet, Joshua Henry. I'm just going to make sure I'm not saying this incorrectly.
That's fine.
Correct. So the Drama Desk also has an Outstanding Ensemble Performance Award, which I don't think is given out always, because you can't like click on it to look at more awards. But In the Heights won the Outstanding Ensemble Performance in 2007 at the Drama Desks. And so Joshua Henry has a Drama Desk Award because he was in the ensemble of In the Heights.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting that the whole ensemble wins an award. Like a yes. like a baseball team. Like, I kind of like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Well, I think the Tonys should
have also my
it.
Campaign for the Tonys having a Best Ensemble Award.
They should.
There's no ensemble, there's no show. There's the also ensemble. So many shows where you can't really pinpoint a lead, or you can't pinpoint supporting act, like dance heavy shows.
Yeah.
Like, they're doing a lot of work.
That's and especially if you get that kind of like Andy Blankenbuehler, every move actually means something in reference to the lyrics, kind of, even if it's abstract, but like the ensemble is part of, not only part of the scenery, they're almost like another character. So it's like, why not reward it when you get a really good one? They're dancing their brains out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's the only time ensemble members, like people who are career ensemble members, who are extremely important members of the theater community, are recognized at all.
Yeah.
There are the Fred Astaire Awards, which I think have become the Cheetah Rivera Awards, that often are what you look to for a dance piece or something with a more heavy ensemble. But for instance, a show like Come From Away, I think would have benefited from a Best Ensemble Tony Award, because there really was not one person you could give a Best Actor or Best Actress Award to.
Yeah.
They all did everything.
Yeah, they really are an ensemble made of individual characters.
Exactly. So like the SAG Awards have a Best Ensemble, is that right?
Huh?
I think just bring it on in.
The frustrating thing with the Tonys is that they have moved on to being
a big
commercial and being a good television broadcast in lieu of actually being good theater awards.
And the Drama Desks are, I think, only locally televised. It might be on New York One.
Yeah. It's really difficult to
get it on MNN.
I think they stream it sometimes.
It's difficult to argue with the Tonys though, because it's like, look, if you can bring in more people by streamlining your awards, like, you know, the more people that get interested in that kind of thing, the better, you know. So
yeah.
It's kind of the Drama Desks are the nerdy Tonys.
Yeah.
Okay. When
I'll go
do they
through the
happen?
Last couple years of winners.
Cool.
If you like. Because there was a 2020 Drama Desks, even though they canceled the Tonys because a lot of off-Broadway shows were already open.
So the Tonys are fully canceled? Just no one got anything? Or?
Oh, they nominated people and said that they would have an award ceremony sometime in November.
That's what I was thinking
too. I didn't see it.
I was waiting for the other shoe to drop, and I just never saw anything more. So I was like, is Aaron Tveit still running on a post for a Tony? Like, I was confused.
I think they're waiting to hold the ceremony when they have a date that shows are opening again, because as we discussed, it's a commercial.
I just think they're going to have us all just pleasantly forget that they nominated people for Tonys.
I think that might be.
I think they'll probably do like a Broadway's coming back, let's give out some Tony Awards while we say... while we look at the shows ahead.
I think they're
like, gonna do it on Twitch.
Yeah, they're gonna do, I think they're gonna do it at, like, on a Friday afternoon and just like bury the news cycle and then be done.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Oh yeah. So some past winners. So the 2020 winner was A Strange Loop, which we've covered here.
Yeah.
Good call.
And we love. 2019 was The Prom.
That's actually hilarious to me that it won the Drama Desk.
Yeah, that's good.
2018, SpongeBob. 2017, Come From Away beat The Band's Visit. Then The Band's Visit went on to win the Tony.
It also beat Hadestown that year, too.
Oh, yeah, the off-Broadway Hadestown.
Yeah.
That is true. Which then, so that's also another thing. The Hadestown production moved. However, they did change a lot of it. So I think there were some actors then nominated from Hadestown, but the production was not eligible for a new award season of a Drama Desk.
Interesting.
Yeah. Shuffle Along. One.
Really?
In 2016. Hamilton in 2015. Let's see. Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, which did also win the Tony. Matilda,
which did not win the Tony.
What did win?
It was something we just covered.
I Kinky Boots?
Yes.
Matilda, yeah.
Kinky Boots not nominated for a Drama Desk.
So they don't know what the Drama Desk looks like.
They do not. Once won in 2012. The Book of Mormon in 2011. Memphis in 2010. Billy Elliot in 2009, Passing Strange, Spring Awakening, The Drowsy Chaperone, Spamalot, Wicked, Hairspray, Thoroughly Modern Millie. The early aughts really brought some bangers. The Producers and Contact in 2000.
Huh.
Okay. Forgot about Contact.
Is it based on the movie with aliens?
It is not, but wouldn't that be fun? It's mostly a
in danger. A way.
I don't even know if there's a story. Other than people contact with each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are the Drama Desks. I like them. One day I think we should go.
I think we could probably go to the Drama Desk.
And I think it is like the Golden Globes that there's dinner.
Oh.
I think you sit at tables.
All right.
Which okay. sounds way more fun than sitting
at a radio station. When do these normally happen?
They are usually like 2 or 3 weeks before the Tonys.
Okay. So it's like summer.
Like Tonys are in June, Drama Desks are in May, something like that.
Okay, we should at least do like a watch through.
Oh yeah. Obviously there won't be one this year.
No.
Not virtually?
There hasn't been any.
Oh, that's
shows,
right,
there's Alex.
No theater. Yeah.
Everything's been closed. I like that you've forgotten, but
I think
we are
it's...
still sad.
Yes. We're almost
Although
out.
Do something like outstanding virtual concerts. No, that gets muddy. I don't
know. Ratatouille wins everything by default.
Yeah. No one watches that, I don't think.
No. That's sad. But again, there won't be a Tonys this year either. So maybe that's why they're holding on to the 2020 Tonys.
Yeah, just
there won't be a Tony.
They got a mulligan Tony.
Do a super Tonys.
Aaron Tveit gets his Tony in 2022.
It's like a regular Tony, but like it's going Super Saiyan. It's all spiky and it glows.
Yeah.
That's nuts. That's making me sad thinking about the next Tonys will be 2022.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Well, then, shall we get into... Oh, the reason I made Drama Desk the word of the week.
Word of the week?
Word of the week.
Say it again. Is the show we are covering, Violet, was off-Broadway in 1997. Nominated for many, many Drama Desk Awards, did not win one. But then when it came up to Broadway in 2014,
something like
that. Sounds right. In 2014, it was not eligible at the Tonys for Best Musical because it had a successful almost just a month and a half run off Broadway, but because it had been nominated for awards, it was in the best revival category in 2000.
Ran for a month and a half?
Yeah.
Huh.
Or did it run for a year and I just misread?
I don't know, because you said successful in month and a half and that kind of didn't compute for me.
Well, a lot of times off-Broadway runs are limited in nature.
Oh, is it supposed to be a month and a half? Okay.
Yeah. Let's see. Violet was developed off-Broadway. Yeah. March 11th to April 6th at Playwrights Horizons. So Playwrights Horizons often, it will have a season. So it'll probably do like three shows in the spring for a month at a time.
Okay.
But it got a cast recording and it got critically reviewed very well. So that it became a revival contender at the Tonys. Yeah.
That off-Broadway album is hard to find. I had to look to YouTube to get it.
So it used to be on Spotify. I used to listen to both of them.
Yeah.
And I don't know where it went because I was trying. The main difference is their Monty's song in 2014 is Last Time I Came to Memphis. And it's called something else. You Are Different, I think.
Yeah.
In 97. But the new song was written for Colin Donnell, who took over that part in 2014.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you know that it started as an we'll just start talking about Violet now. I'm okay. Ready. I'm ready with the facts.
All right.
Mainly, I just wanted to say to you, Jay Schmidt, who loves this man so much, and he's your brethren now.
Okay.
So the 2014 production started as an Encores production, and then it transferred to Broadway.
Yeah. I knew that.
Not all of the cast was the same when it came to Broadway.
Christopher Sieber.
Christopher Sieber was the preacher and the bus driver.
No way.
That's good casting.
Probably so good.
I know.
Why didn't he transfer?
He was in Shrek. No, that wasn't at that time.
That was probably the prom building up to that, maybe? Yeah, out of town trying out at that point?
Probably.
Yeah, probably.
I don't know. Anyway, let's talk about personal histories of Violet, and we will start with my baby Jay Schmidt.
I played the preacher in college. We did a college production of it, and it was really fun. And I fell in love with the show, and then I saw it. It's in heavy rotation if I'm listening to musicals. It's a perfect album to put on and like clean the house. Kimberly was kind enough to get me a ticket to go see it. See the revival with Sutton Foster and all them.
Oh,
yeah, because she was a good girlfriend at that point. Now an even better wife. Look at that.
Thank you. You were gonna go a different direction with that sentence, and I appreciate you for saying.
What did you think I was gonna say?
I'm like, look where she is now. Or
no, I was always meant to. I was always gonna be nice.
Oh, that's very sweet.
Oh, why do you expect me to be mean? I'm nice.
I just expected you to make a joke. Oh. Not I didn't expect you to be mean.
Okay.
Anyway. My introduction to Violet is a friend of mine had, we just liked to rush tickets together and we got rush seats. And then I told Jay that I canceled a date or something because it was early on in our relationship within the first year or two. And I said, oh, I'm not going to make it tonight. I got tickets to Violet. And you're like, did you get me one? I love that show. I want to see it.
I want to go.
And so I went.
I'm not usually like that. I normally can be like, oh, have fun, have a great time. But I was like, I was one of the first times I was ever like, I'm coming too.
Yeah.
So I went there. I'm just excited.
Jay, a rush ticket. And I was sitting in like the third row center of the mezzanine, but Jay was sitting alone in a box off to the side. Mm-hmm. And so I got what I like to call previewed in real life.
Yeah.
Because I got to watch the show, but I also had a great view of watching Jay watch the show. And he just wept like a little baby the entire time.
Yeah, it's a beautiful show.
Yeah. And you know, that's how, when he realized that people like to watch him watch things. And now look at his YouTube channel.
Oh boy.
I do like watching you watch things.
I know, it's annoying.
Yeah, I know. Even if I don't watch all your videos. Anyway, Alex, do you have any connection at all to Violet until we forced you to listen to it this week?
So I had heard the name ever since we started doing the show, mainly because I knew Jay loved it. And I believe Broadway Sid interviewed Colin Donnell at BroadwayCon when I went. So it was spoken of again. So Violet to me was always this show that I just heard whispers of. And it almost had this like mythic quality, like, oh, eventually I'll get so deep into Broadway that I will listen to that. And that was pretty much it.
And here we are. We listened through, I guess you found the off-Broadway recording.
Yeah.
We listened through the Broadway recording. And I tried to send you as many clips as I could find.
I found two regional productions and a bunch of Tony clips. And I read the summary of the original short story. And they are, it is vastly darker.
Is it?
Yeah.
I have not really looked into it, but as musicals often are, I'm sure it was much darker.
It would kind of ruin the vibe in this room if I actually tell you what happens. So
then that's fine. Is it like Little Mermaid? She turns into foam on the
water. Kind of.
Cool. Great. Well, we're going to.
The ending is kind of the same. The middle is more fucked up.
Oh, sure. That makes sense. I love Violet. I like the storytelling of it with flashbacks on Broadway. Emerson Steele, who played young Violet. I was just blown away. She was so good.
Yeah. Well, it's an important part of the thing. Like,
yeah. Cause she has to, you have to see young Violet deal with all the raw emotions of being sort of freshly wounded and prior to the wound. And then you see Sutton Foster dealing with all of these pent up emotions of how it has affected her life.
Yeah.
And so when the two are sort of in duet with each other, it's very good.
Yeah, you see things that she's going to eventually play with in Fun Home.
Sure. Yeah. And the idea of, I haven't really put the two together, but you're so right, because at the end, the change in her that comes is the forgiveness of her father.
Yeah.
With the preacher. And Absolutely. That's why she feels that she has changed and thinks so much that her face has changed. And then it's very sad to watch her not be different, but be very different. Mm-hmm. It's very sad.
Yeah. I just think, I think this is, in my opinion, Sissori's best score. I think it's got it's a very emotive score, but also there's some catchy tunes in it. Like the Playing Cards with Her Father song is catchy as all get out. I sing that like anytime anyone brings up poker, that's immediately what comes to my mind. Like there's some Tesori can sometimes get a little too stylistic for, You're not really walking home humming much of it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I found that the first third of this, she tends to interrupt a good song with a scene that, if I'm honest, I'm not that interested in. And I found it kind of frustratingly touch and go. And then toward the middle, the music, I think, got stronger. Like, it was all made of good pieces, but I'm just like, we were having a good song. Why is this old lady yammering now?
Yeah. I mean,
I'm going to Nashville.
Oh, yes. I love it.
Every time someone says Nashville.
I'm going to Nashville.
Country music capital of the world. We listen to that song a lot.
My son works in the cellophane plant.
The girls, they are scattered to the wind.
And they such beautiful brides. I'm right tired of children.
Yeah, it's literally, anytime anyone says Nashville around here, it literally is the first. Yeah, I feel like that's going to become a catchphrase around our house when there's eventually kids in it. I'm right tired of children.
And like the way she says it.
Yeah, I just think the show. But when it comes to the speaking stuff and interjecting, I think you're right in that it's when you see the show, it just feels, it's very seamless and feels very like it almost feels world buildy. But like when you're listening through it and you don't really see that, it can feel a little disjointed.
Yeah, this was a show I made a point to find. Like, I need to find any production of it, because I need to see it in context. Like, this is, I know sometimes shows that I've like, you haven't gravitated to as much because you're like, I wish I was in the room to see it. And this is a show where I was like, I need the script, and I still wonder how I would feel if I actually was in the room with the spectacle of it.
The main thing I say about seeing the show, I went in completely blind. I didn't really know the show at all. Maybe you had played me one song before we saw it. But what I didn't realize is that always the actress playing Violet, there's no makeup to tell you that she has any sort of deformity.
Yeah.
It's implied.
It's implied that it's there. And I remember the first like 15 minutes of the show being like, I wonder why they didn't do that.
My and exact
I
wonder question.
Why. And then I was just like, because it's not important. That's all everyone would look at. And then no one would look at Violet and no one would listen to the story. And so it's not important that you see that. And now I'm thinking of a story I was about to credit to Sutton Foster, but what was this, Ithaca? Of what? The girl who played Violet in your production had pictures, like reference photos.
Yeah.
Taped backstage.
Uh-huh.
So that everyone knew what they were reacting to.
Yeah.
On her face. And she knew what she looked like.
I like in some of the choreography, I didn't notice until I watched the Tony performance like four times that she runs her hand down her face to imply the scar, which is good because it was driving me crazy imagining what it would look like. So I was like, okay, I have some kind of reference point.
Yeah. And they say like, what, cut like a rainbow on my cheek.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've always picked, I don't know. But it did take me out of it for like the first couple of minutes. And then once I got used to it, you just use the audience imagination, but it lets you connect with the character more than watching to see if her makeup's falling off, you know?
If I'm honest, it made me connect a little less because it just...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, because it made me kind of feel like, first of all, it feels a little gimmicky, like a little bit like you never see the scar, man. But also it feels like in certain scenes, they just don't want the scar to be as relevant. Like when she talks to the soldiers, they just don't care for no... They don't react really, and I feel like it's partly they want the townsfolk to react to her, but then when reacting would get in the way, they want it to not matter. So it felt, this story felt a kind of a mess to me. And I'm trying really hard to not make this episode hot take central. I really don't want it to sound like I'm being an asshole, but I had a lot of problems with the show.
I mean, I'd love your hot takes because I'll watch Jay cut them all down with a machete.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm coming here with an open mind. I just did I tell Alex when we picked this show that if he didn't like it, I'm gonna find him and teach him to like it.
Yes. There may have been an axe blade, just gently, not brandished, but not brandished.
Yeah. Implied. It was implied.
Just a gleam.
Yeah, I remember watching it that they like notice her scar.
Yeah.
But they're soldiers. They see scars all the time.
I guess so. But isn't one of them supposed to be really shallow?
Than just like a woman who's never been to Nashville. You know?
Yeah.
Also, I think a lot of the like the parallels between her and Flick are what's really supposed to be part of the story too, that they've both always been judged by their skin and that's how they have a strong connection.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, which if I'm being totally honest, yes, but also comparing having a scar to being black in the South in the 60s is a little bit dicey territory to conflate.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
It feels a little bit like, oh, okay. Like, but I get the point is that people look at me badly and so do you, so we understand each other.
Just they both have something to overcome before people meet the real them, quote unquote. Because her scar meets people first. Inherent prejudices meet people first.
Yes.
Yeah.
In Flick's sense. Jay was also talking today that the song Let It Sing.
Let It Sing is like maybe one of the better songs a guy gets to sing in any show ever. And when we saw it, Joshua Henry, it's one of the best things I've ever seen. He
I wanted to stand, I think.
He got a standing ovation when we were there. Okay. Oh, he definitely did.
Just from that song or at the end of the day?
No. At the end of that song.
Good.
It was incredible. And it's also one of the few moments, and good for Janine, in that it's one of the few times... Like I can count on like one hand how many songs, like a really powerful ballad where it's not just about like the emotion and the acting of it, but it's like a guy gets to like really sing a song. Yeah. Like guys don't get like, you know, Defying Gravity. The guys never get that number.
An 11 o'clock number almost.
Never. It's very rare. It's very rare. But like, man, he sang the absolute crap out of that song.
Which I kind of enjoy because usually like these crazy 11 o'clock acrobatic vocal numbers are written by men for women. And then Jerry was like, I want to write one for a man.
Yeah.
It's true. They don't have enough or enough that like in the context of the show can be sung like that. A lot of times you'll see people play with crazy versions of songs in concerts, but at a show they play it pretty straight.
Yeah, it's there are some lulls, like when they get to Nashville, or they in Memphis, when they get to Memphis, there's a lull. There's definitely a lull from a storytelling perspective.
Yeah, once they get off the bus, forgive the pun, the story starts to spin its wheels a bit.
Yeah. And I can admit that, but also fight me.
pick the right one, baby.
I don't know. I just, I think like the act break is a little, it comes out of nowhere.
Where is the act break?
The act break is,
because in Broadway it's one act, and then off Broadway was two. But I was wondering where that split was.
It was only one act on Broadway.
Yep.
I guess it was.
Yeah, because it should be. Shouldn't have an act break.
Yeah, but the concept of a no act break commercial musical was a hard sell for a while, because then you couldn't sell concessions in intermission.
Mm. The act break is, I believe,
Lay Down Your Head.
No. No, it's after Anyone Would Do, and then Lay Down Your Head is supposed to open up Act Two.
Okay. Yeah, that makes enough dramatic sense to be, but we are going to sleep together.
When we did it at Ithaca, they ended it after Lay Down Your Head.
Interesting. Yeah, that's kind of not a very exciting place to
stop. Them doing it in one act actually made so much more sense. Like, it's a little long, but it's better than, it just doesn't really have a, it doesn't have a firm point in the middle there to like really, damn it, Alex. Yeah, you're right. There's certain aspects of the show that are not perfect, but musically this show is better than 99% of shows.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely agree.
I feel like, I don't know, we cried today listening to it while we folded laundry.
Yeah, it's just, it was never about getting healed. It was about finding someone. It was just about, the whole point is like, look at me. She just wanted someone to look at her. That's it.
When the show is at its strongest, it's when the music and like, especially the arrangements are really rich, when it really hammers home how it feels like to just live in Violet's head. Like I'm a big fan of that subgenre of Broadway songs, which is, it doesn't even necessarily have to be a huge moment for the character, but you just get, this is what the music in their head sounds like all the time. Not literally, but emotionally. And so when you get, look at me, and she's freaking out, you go, oh, this is what it feels like. That's what's playing in her head all the time. So those moments where they show what her pain feels like were very strong character moments.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, I mean, this is one of my little loves, but I'll say it now. When she's talking to Flick or Monty about going to the healer, and he's like, you believe in that stuff? And she's like, you believe in, oh, now I forget what the her actual,
don't you believe in God? I don't believe you're talking me to a TV.
Yeah, that too. And she was like, if you want it bad enough, you believe in it, something like that.
Yeah, which I feel is not a good enough.
You need to enough.
Yeah, I think this show, so the my central problem with this show, mm-hmm. and this could just be my personality, and also I haven't seen the show, so when you make the choice to have your main character casually believe that faith healers are real, it is very much implied that at the end they're going to realize that they're not. But for me, faith healers are such a visible, like you can just look at them and see, oh, that's what a charlatan looks like, that is such a no shit revelation that it takes away some of the dramatic tension for me. And so you go, oh, she's going to realize it's not real. The scar is going to stay, and she's going to learn that real beauty is in her. Like, it kind of telegraphs its own ending by its premise. And when you have that be the central trait of a character, and I don't love that I'm going to say this, you have made a drastic statement about their critical thinking skills that makes me less interested in their journey. I'm interested in her pain because the show is so vivid in how it describes it. And I feel for her, really, I do. But like, they have all these, there's these lines like, she goes, I never thought of it as a show before. I'm like, you've watched this show for hundreds of hours, Violet. You never thought, it just feels like I'm not as invested in their journey because of that choice.
Yeah.
And I don't feel great about thinking that, but that's what
I'm saying. No, I see your point. And it's actually frustrating when, it's frustrating to see the portrayal of the preacher in certain productions, because it's written in such an over the top way.
Yeah.
That it's the kind of thing where, like, I think it's a smarter choice from a director, like a director and an actor choice perspective as the preacher, to like, you can't have people who don't at least understand what it could be putting that up. It's the kind of thing where, as someone who like I did that, that was the part that I played in college.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was like, I came at it from a, he did it once, or at least thought he did. And so there was a part of him that actually bought it. It hasn't worked since, but he made a career out of it. And it's the kind of thing where it's like, this can't be a joke. I was like, if this is a joke to the people who are doing it, then yeah, it discredits the entire thing.
Yeah.
And the like, I like the idea that like the people who are involved in that production on a certain level, low key believe in it. But I think that's on the director.
Yeah. And I know we said it's not quite valid to be like, well, I wish the show had done this, but I would have maybe been a little more in it if it was like a plastic surgeon to the stars and she just couldn't be talked out of that he wouldn't have done worked on her. So that when she gets there, it's like, oh, go away. And then it would actually be like, oh no, like my last earthly option, but she's intent on it being this guy. And you can just look at him and tell that it's not real. So it's hard for me to, and I know part of it is supposed to be like an impending doom. Like, you know, it's not going to work, but also that takes out a lot of the thrust of the story for me.
I didn't feel that way when I saw it. And I don't know if that's just, the direction was very good in 2014.
Yeah.
It could also be the magic of like musical realism. Is
that's
that
what I'm wondering.
I could buy into the fact that someone in the 60s in the mountains of North Carolina thought that was church and believed that that was church and that what this man was doing was real. It was the 60s. It was like people were not as cynical as we are now, especially as New Yorkers. But so I believed that she believed it, but I never did as an audience member.
Yeah.
But there was always a part of me at the end that was like, well, it's a musical. Maybe it works.
I actually would be very interested to see what if it did, so that it would be a big switcheroo. Obviously, that would make it an entirely different
that would be
show.
A different show, Alex.
It would. I've got some, before we do loves or if we have anything else, I have some questions that I would like cleared up about the narrative.
Sure.
I'm approaching, like I said, I don't want this to be hot take central. I really wanted to approach this from what am I missing, not like doing some kind of asshole victory dance. I don't want to do that. Mm. So she accuses her dad of literally saying, you hurt me on purpose so that I wouldn't leave. But we have seen several memories of her and her father. Seems pretty cool. So all that stuff at the end, like, and not even just the stuff where she goes, sorry, it's not going to take away the last 12 years of pain. I get that. That's a very reasonable thing to say. Like, yes, I know you're intellectually sorry, but like, you know, look at me, as she says. But she makes that accusation, and we've seen nothing other than the dad seems like a pretty solid dad. So then the turnover where he goes, I took care of you and made you strong again, kind of feels like, yeah, we know. And I guess, are we supposed to think that she's making baseless accusations? Because I don't think that's dramatically what I'm supposed to believe. That's how it feels.
Are there scenes missing from the recording? Because I don't remember him being always a great guy.
Finding me on the live show.
I mean, I think it's the kind of thing where, I mean, she calls it out. She's just like, you could have taken me to the doctor. You waited like this long. Like,
You took me to a doctor who was drunk.
Yeah.
She says all of that.
Yeah. Dude, he was desperate. It was like the middle of the night.
I think it's also she's coming to grips with, but she's also wrestling with a ghost. And, you know, he's dead at this point. That's the whole reason she leaves. He's gone.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just her wrestling with.
It's also her writing her own memories again. Like,
yeah.
maybe she didn't want to remember that that's how it happened until she is actually confronted with the fact that it won't go away.
Okay. So I was a little right that these aren't actually all that based in reality. These are emotional.
No, I think she's kind of...
I think the earlier ones, I think she's only remembering the good things until that's how I always read it, until the end and you flip it and you're like, oh, he wasn't perfect. She's remembering him as perfect, but he wasn't. She's remembering him as perfect because she has this hope that like the Lord will heal all and her face will be fine again and blah, blah, blah. And then at the end, she has to sit and deal with the fact that it could have been different, but it wasn't. And this is her life.
Okay. Cause I don't think the show gives any, I don't think the show gives any indication that that's what it is. But honestly, if a director made it like that, that would actually put me much more into the story, because one of the reasons why I don't fully feel much by the end with the, no, but now I've forgiven my father and my scar is healed, is because I was just like, yeah, he seemed fine. But if you could maybe work it in the direction that these are cloudy memories on purpose, like these are touched up and airbrushed almost, and that she's not remembering something darker, that would actually make me more sympathetic to her.
But also
being like, this has to work and I'm a little crazy. It's not that I'm just a little bit.
Is it a great dad teaching her kid how to play poker, like with drunk dudes?
But I also think, I mean, people who have like, you know, who had pretty good childhoods still find a way to be mad at their parents. You know what I mean? I think it's the kind of thing where it's like, I think it's less of the father is like becomes like the personification of her dealing with the fact that like, this is how it's going to be.
This is her life.
This is what it is. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't even necessarily know. Like, it's such a personal song that her dad sings, and I think it's a really sweet moment. But I think that whole situation is less about him defending himself and more about like her just realizing, her learning how to forgive life.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't think it necessarily needs to be spelled out specifically. I think the music and like the mood and the tone of that whole sequence going from the preacher into the father, I think that kind of does a lot of, it's subtle, but I think it's there.
Okay. What's the significance of the book specifically making it a Catholic, as opposed to she's from this very clearly like Baptist or Protestant place? And I can see it, obviously it harkens back to memories, but like, I was very unsure of what the mom's role in her journey is supposed to be. Obviously she's dead, so now she's alone, but like, what is the book really saying about the piece as a whole to be used as such an important device? I was really muddy on that.
I don't really know.
I didn't find it that important.
I didn't. Yeah, I kind of forget.
They point to it a lot. Like,
yeah,
she just has a part of her mom with her because she died when she was young. She died before the axe blade.
Yeah, I don't know.
So, is it a what could have been sort of thing?
I guess.
Maybe, or no? I don't think she died. She left, right?
No, she died.
No, she died.
She died.
Yeah.
And why did she say? Do you think Mama would have stayed? Oh. To leave you like mama. Wasn't there something like that?
Mama left, but she died.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Just a polite way of saying that she died.
Oh, I thought she left.
No.
And I thought that's why he was more hurt and trying to keep her with him and disfigure his daughter.
No.
Okay.
All right. All right.
Fine.
Should move on to...
I apparently read that wrong. Alex, more questions?
Let me see. No, I think that might be it.
Okay. Do you have little gripes?
I have one more question. These were all kind of a slow motion little gripe. So we have Luck of the Draw, which is a fun song about he's teaching her math with poker, which is neat. And he's also, and this is another reason why I'm like, he seems okay. He's teaching her to get over he's teaching her a tool to get over social anxiety. So he's like doing the best he can. So he has this the chorus, which is a very fun, snappy tune, where he says there's no decrees and laws and whatnot. Everything's luck of the draw. Now, Violet also is singing that at the same time on stage with the poker players. But everything's luck of the draw. There's no demand to create. That's like something an atheist would, that's like something I would say. And yet, doesn't that kind of be at odds with her whole character being, I'm putting all my faith in religion? It feels like it doesn't quite gel to me.
I don't know, man.
I don't know.
I've literally never thought about
I've never thought about that. sure.
I feel like it's just, it is a perfect device to show, like we were talking about earlier when you were like, oh, the soldiers don't seem like that bothered by her. And it's like, well, the poker, she knows how to play poker. And that's how she ingratiates herself with these two guys and kind of gets through the, them kind of freaking out about her face scar and all that. I think it's like, if anything, I think maybe it could very well stand for the, like, what her dad actually did teach her, and she takes a while to figure out. It's just like,
okay,
it didn't actually mean anything when the axe hit you. It just was it was just shit luck.
And then she, like, that's rebelled against it
so hard to her mother's Bible.
That actually would make a lot of sense.
All right, direct it. You
you know, it's like,
I'm off.
I think it's like her dad, like her coming to terms with like everything with her dad. I think she realizes that, like, yeah, it just, I did the best I could. It wasn't perfect. It just, it's kind of how the cards landed. I don't know what to tell you.
And she was like, my mom believed in this.
And this is like,
and maybe this was right. Maybe she tried hard enough to believe in this, she'd still be here. So I'll go to the person on TV that believes the hardest.
And you got the worst hand imaginable. You got to just bluff your way into a winning hand.
Okay. Interesting.
And isn't there a flashback where she goes to a faith healer as a child?
That's a dream sequence that she's going to the...
Dream sequence. Dream
but
it.
She does say that she has been to faith healers before.
Yeah.
Even a Catholic one, like my mom.
Is there a Catholic faith healer? Sure. Probably.
Why not? I'm...
Where's that? Yep, whatever.
Money's so green, ain't it?
Mm-hmm.
All right, little loves.
You. Oh, you're looking at me first?
Yeah.
Oh, I love the bus. I think it's fun.
Just because you drove it.
It's a fun thing. I just feel like she really fleshes out the bus really well. I love the when they're all singing about what they're going to get at the bus stop, at like the pit stop, when they're like,
barbecue and pie.
Have a cup of coffee.
Oh,
like, it's just fun.
For the room.
Yeah. I also, I don't have a lot of little loves. I just have a bit. I just love this show. It just makes me happy. And,
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Sorry. I just really, like, I don't really have, like, a lot of, like, it's hard to, like, pick out the little things.
Well, obviously, it's, I'm going to Nashville. My biggest little love is all of the weird dialogue during I'm on my way. Because, like, we've all sat next to the Chatty Cathy on the bus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hot in here.
I don't think there's like a dry eye on the house when, like, the scene leading up to That's What I Could Do with the dad song, when he's just like, I did the best I could, and like lays it out. I don't think like any parent in the house is like not like like kind of a puddle at that point.
Yeah.
I also, another little love, and I'll go. Okay. I really like how they're both rehearsing how they're going to, like, break it off. And then Monty just goes right into, like, promise me, Violet. Like, completely changes his tune and just, like, loses himself. And I just was like, I find that, like, there's a lot of realism in that. And it's the kind of thing where he's just, like, he doesn't have the courage to. But also, he's kind of, Monty's a good guy. He just doesn't know how to do it right. And. Yeah, it gets a little muddy, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, no one in this show is perfect, which I appreciate about Violet. Yeah. I've always thought that it would be a perfect, when the last 5 years the movie was made, I was like, great, now there's proof that like an indie musical movie can happen, and I've always thought it should be Violet, because it is a small, if it was a movie, it would be an indie movie. It's not.
Yeah.
It probably should have stayed off Broadway for years. Broadway, like, it's a little small for Broadway, a little weird for Broadway.
Yeah.
You could do cool stuff like she's looking out the window and like the flashback starts to come in through the window. From...
And like when you see her scar, like you only see her scar when people are looking at her or something. Like you could do all sorts of.
You only see her scars in reflections.
In reflections.
Oh, yeah. That's good.
And in other people's eyes.
Yeah.
Like you could do really fun things with this because it is.
Yeah, this is a show
a
that
flawed
I think.
Story.
I think this show would lend it just from the mechanics of that it's a show about memory. It would lend itself to film, I think, pretty interestingly, because you could basically have an excuse to like do time bending and visual effects to like weave this.
And how human. You produce the television show versus the backstage of the television show.
Yeah.
All of it would be very cool. And that's another pitch from me today. You get a lot of them. We got a lot of, a lot of petitions on my end. My Little Loves. I love the poker scene. My dad also taught me how to play poker as a young child, which I think is funny. It didn't help me with math, I don't think. I was good at math, though. So.
Was? What happened?
I stopped taking math classes.
Oh, that's fair.
I went to school for theater.
Yeah.
Goodbye, numbers.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Hello, numbers.
I was great at math in high school.
A 5, 6, 7, 8.
I sing now. I don't need you. I have a calculator on my iPhone. And true, that is exactly what is happening. What else are my little loves? I love when she's saying what she wants to look like.
Yeah.
That song. Is that all to pieces?
Yeah. For the eyebrows.
It's catchy. It's that song and On My Way that I listen to the most often and Let It Sing. Catchy, catchy songs.
Yeah.
I love them very much.
But then when they reprise it and she's like completely losing it,
reprises are very strong in this show.
She's so desperate that it
like, I think what we're that's talking, why
that's why I
can accept that she believes in the faith healer, because
she's so desperate
for this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that she doesn't, I'm just saying it makes the journey less of a interesting for me.
Yeah,
I don't doubt that the character does, but yeah, I think that's what you meant. I misinterpreted. Yeah. Any more?
Your loves.
Okay, "Lonely Stranger" is such a good rock song.
Yeah.
That like it's almost what Janine Tesori is such a good songwriter that we could talk about this. We could have gone this whole podcast without talking about some of the songs in the middle that are really, really, really good as well. They're just slightly less dramatically relevant, so they could. But like even the stuff that's you know, isn't the stuff that you would gravitate to immediately because it's more background. It's still really good. It's still really good. I like the part, the melody and the string arrangements when she's, I think it's in Alter Pieces, because that's like sort of an up-tempo, like, I love her all, I want Ava Gardner's eyebrow, all that. But then there's this moment of that's more like solemn. She goes, I want my own as soft as the breeze, with this string line that comes in, do do do, and it's like that's the moments I'm talking about that are very strong, like when the strings are telling me this is what it feels like to be Violet. I think that's when the show is at its best. I like when she's losing it in the church, going, look at me, and reprising everything, and you feel like what it's like to have been her this whole time, and that she's on some level putting on this hopeful show for herself, because if she doesn't, she will fall apart. And then in the finale, I really like that little part where the chorus kind of get the instruments all die out, and she goes, if I show you the darkness I hold inside, and then it all comes back in.
Yeah.
It's a very, very human moment. And that's why I said like the character stuff I think is the strongest stuff here, and the music elevates it in a really great way.
Yeah. I forgot about Bring Me to Light, the finale. Speaking of listening to finales of Janine Tesori's,
mm-hmm.
I could also listen to Bring Me to Light forever.
Oh, it's my least favorite song.
Oh, really?
Oh, I really don't like it.
Yeah, it's I think still, it's fine.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah, for me, I don't know why. It's like
it doesn't necessarily gel with the rest of the show, but I like that they all got to sing some more for me.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's a great, it's fine. It's fine, but it's more for me, it's the ending of the show is when Flick reprises the look at me stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's that's where I'm like, okay, we got it. Like, Bring Me to Light just kind of feels like we needed a conclusion and this is good. So here we go.
Yeah, it's a little Song of Purple Summer.
A little bit. Tie everything back up.
Exactly. What would Harold do if he saw Violet?
Oh, he's getting out. Jay Schmidt's going to come out swinging at Harold. There's going to be a cricket bat with that man's name on it. You know? Get out.
He's the old lady on the bus, basically.
Yeah.
He's in his chair going, I'm right tired of children, too.
You'd be right tired of this cricket bat.
Yeah. Would you smash the phone first as a warning or just go right for?
No, the phone's just getting punted.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're sprung cricket bats.
They're sprung?
Yeah, they're built with a little spring to them.
What?
Nothing.
Okay.
Nothing.
I was like, I don't really understand. Okay. Is there a review?
Got a review. Where did I put it? There we go. This was the one we did on our last episode, but that was lost to the ages. So,
okay.
This is from Cookie Kids, 5 stars. Please leave Broadway Baby 5 stars and a nice review in your podcast app. It really helps our numbers. I don't know if you can do it on Spotify too, but we are now on Spotify. Nothing is more fun than listening to truly hilarious, smart, and passionate people talking about the thing they love. And listening to this podcast is so happy making. The chemistry is amazing, and their insights brought such joy to this musical theater lover. Bravo, Kimberly, Jay, and Alex. Thank you.
Thank you. Bravo to you.
Yes.
Well, then it's time. Sing out, Louise.
Listen to their voices, clear as day, smooth as silk. Hear how the breath is not overblown. Gives their notes such a tone. I take it any day. Praise pod for everyone I meet while I am on Broadway. I am on Broadway before an old depression hits me, before another sadness strikes. I'll find out where this podcast gets me and trade in my regrets for likes. And as I'm listening along, I'll carry with me little loves from every song as I travel on Broadway.
Yay!
Yay! First thing I'll do is rate it 5 stars for you.
Okay.
Will you bring me to life? Will you bring me to life? Will you bring me to ooh.